So we're really happy to have this collaboration with the Elliott House. And so I have Kate Colby, who is our old board member, brought this to our attention, and we're happy to have these poets here. And so, Kate, take it away.
Thanks, Henry. I have a habit of losing my voice whenever I get up here to speak in this space. Amanda knows that. I'm going to try not to. Thank you all for being here tonight. Timothy Donnelly's poems evince the trickeries of perception and its preference for the particular, foiling our apprehension of what would be seen at the widest aperture and complete scale. But his rendering of the particular, Quetzal feathers, hyacinth, and diesel, shows how in our pursuit of the unknown, we neglect the bottomlessness of what's already here. In The Cloud Corporation, he explores this frustrated longing to understand the nature of all things and of each thing, to comprehend and contain everything at once, from within a fine mesh of manufactured needs and the exigencies of daily living, where politically subjugated bodies battle for attention with pecuniary concerns and rotisserie chicken. Constructed clouds part to reveal their inescapable plexus. In these complex poems, the sensing self is always in the way of its capacity to find meaning, blocking the very light it's desperate to absorb and see with. Born in Providence, Rhode Island, Timothy Donnelly is the author of two collections of poetry, The Cloud Corporation and 27 Props for a Production of Ina Liebenscheidt.
Did I say that? Yeah.
His work has been translated into German and Italian and has appeared in numerous anthologies and publications, including The Nation, The New Yorker, and The Paris Review. His several awards and fellowships include a Guggenheim and the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. He's a professor in the writing program at Columbia University School of the Arts, as well as poetry editor at the Boston Review. He lives with his family in Brooklyn. Please welcome to me.
Okay. Is this working?
Yeah. It's just for the podcast.
We're good. Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you, Henry, and thank you, Anne, and thank you, of course, Kate, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to read, I think, 9 poems, but if it starts to seem like I'm going on too long, I may abbreviate that to 8 or maybe even 7. The first I'm reading is a poem I call Stunt. Early on in the undertaking, I imagined backing out of it. This allowed me to continue outwardly while inwardly I'd stopped. Not to make too much of it, but everything followed accordingly. The human, in my experience, will speak until you agree. Agree, or it will lean too close and bring its hands. Protect what refuses by corrupting it into something scarce. I don't want to ruin it, but in reality, there's no choice. I agree about the weather. I agree to the human voice in its red declamation. But when what punishes has penned itself in sleep, I reduce what words it uses into a toxin I can sing. Fascination. Raleigh filled his cargo hold with sassafras to carry it from the New World to England, hoping it cured syphilis, which it didn't, but its fragrance was just heavenly enough to make you think a miracle wasn't completely out of the question. Elizabeth herself looked out across the blue hypnosis of ocean, saw infection in the form of 132 Spanish vessels, and prohibited the setting sail of any one of England's own, having awakened to a military need for many hulls, for masts that tower, for wind-loud fabrics but bettered with use, for decks seasoned by the tread of subjects, their finer British aspects, reserve, and so forth. Meanwhile, John White, governor of Roanoke, rich in sassafras but otherwise an inauspicious choice for the crown's toehold in the Americas, is back in town for emergency supplies and aid. But given Elizabeth's stay of shipping, won't be allowed to return to Roanoke for years. 2 long years, White pounds his pewter tankard down, having abandoned wife and daughter to an end without an author, his tankard cylindrical, lidded with an acorn thumb piece and filled with ale, whose froth spatters on the tabletops in meaningful patterns he can't yet discern. First the arrowhead of Hatteras, then a crescent of the Armada, then at last a mitten or 1 or 3 lobed leaf of sassafras, frequent thickener of stews for the Choctaw, who still dry its foliage and grind it into a powder high in mucilage, which is found also in quantity in okra, whose seed pods are said to have been taken from Africa to feed the colony's growing slave population as cheaply as possible. High on the list of heat and drought resistant crops, okra means to live despite untenable conditions and deserves a tribute unique among those owed to every plant whose leaf, root, flower, berry, bark, or fruit has gotten us as far as this without complaint. Aloe, apple, artichoke, and asparagus to start, then aubergine, a favorite of Alexander the Great, who carried it from India and into Babylon despite his astronomer's warning that the thunderous local deity, Marduk, had enough already, but the Macedonian was pretty sure a promise to repair Marduk's temple, in ruins since Sennacherib toppled it, and felt by fringe historians to have been the true Tower of Babel, might serve to soften the god's heart. But apparently not. Alexander's coffin, all gold, filled with rumored honey and carried west, far from his deathbed in the palace built by Nebuchadnezzar centuries earlier, came to rest in Alexandria, founded by and named for himself, site where his successor Ptolemy eventually built the celebrated library that Callimachus worked at and whose fiery destruction was traumatic as a blunt force to the head of humanity. You can still feel it today. Cherokee drank a tea of sassafras root to dispollute the blood in Raleigh's day, but knew never to drink it more than a week at a time. English colonists came, saw, and concocted a copycat tonic that mutated into the diet root beer I have here. Its frothy head no longer an intricate play of sassafras mucilage because the FDA determined a principle in the root was hepatocarcinogenic to rodent life in 1960. Now most manufacturers add extract of soap bark to parrot the effect. In his Life of Alexander, Plutarch recalls that the hero was born on the same day Herostratus set the temple of Diana and Hephaestus ablaze so that his name would live forever. Soap bark acts as a foaming agent in many fire extinguishers. Without his imprisonment and brace of assistance, Raleigh wouldn't have produced The History of the World, whose first book states the greatest wonder of the earth is the palm tree. I have stood beneath a tall one in L.A. and watched its fronds seethe like the mane of a lion. Diana's temple, the way the Ephesian workforce fixed it, is remembered as one of the 7 wonders of antiquity, its chalk-white blinding under chicory-blue Turkish skies. I hear the fingertips of history thrum on tabletops in Roanoke, and when popcorn bursts as it spins in my microwave, when I open the bag opposite my kitchen window, the night reflects my face back in at me through the steam expressed from kernels to fasten its way back into the water cycle in order to be the rain that fed the sassafras we hid in before I had to be human. Malamute. When I was a dog, I pulled the sled with the other dogs into the crest of my ability, for never was I a snob about it. Moreover, never lazy, day into night through the cold pine forest we were bred to, and for which I came to feel love as fast as others as a blur that slowed around us at our suppers, then watched us twitch in our heavy sleep. When I was a dog, I pulled the sled with the other dogs, mile on mile convincingly. My tongue construed the forest, no condition not to drape in, identical its pinkness from my open mouth as theirs. The nylon tapes between us, reinforcing sentiment, a kind relief through constant focus, but from what I failed to grasp, as did our language. When I was a dog, I pulled the sled with the other dogs who didn't know I did didn't know, but that was what we were meant to be there for to begin with. Yet I could follow them who followed anyone behind us through the forest where what seemed to know but was a shape without sufficient contour hovered, and it proved some trouble to me. When I was a dog, I pulled the sled with the other dogs, concealing my disquiet like a shoulder bone. The forebears said to hurry up now, Barry, but everywhere the dirt rebuffed my larger purpose. A fortitude from all the earth had frozen up against me, the pause of whom had brought me nowhere but to shame to let it drop for another mouth. When I was a dog, I pulled the sled with the other dogs, the way a roof collapses constantly, and even as the wind must always push, or it isn't wind, it's air. And I was air that had come to think of it. In some trouble to me, the others felt no twitch of, or if they did, our language failed what must have been its purpose, or I won't soon be a dog again. Thank you. This poem is for a close personal friend of mine, the poet Mark Strand, who I never anticipated having as an important personal part of my life. But I got to know him about 5 years before he died, and we taught together. He was my colleague up at Columbia, and he meant a great deal to me. And I call this poem NyQuil. Everyone had been going on about the wind and what in the world they were planning to do about it. Some had decided to make large plastic shields to relieve themselves of its various effects, while others surrendered to it readily, opening up all their windows and doors and just letting it have its way with them. To these I gave my admiration, to the others, my respect. But is there nothing in between, I asked, conveying myself to the couch as one might assist a visitor of great wisdom and delicacy across a divide, a contemplative type, which I had theretofore not known myself to be. How long I must have slept there, how deeply. Once in a dream, I laid hands on a shield of bronze with silver inlay, emblazed with the head of a fox, but woke instead to find them reaching out for the window and ready to open it. Only by then, the wind had stopped, and there was no one anywhere to go on with, for a calm had overtaken the air, the long blue calm about which nothing can be said. This is called Apologies from the Ground Up. There was a time when I was walking back from, after I wrote my book, The Cloud Corporation, I went through a bit of a dry spell. And there was a time when I was coming home from I live in Brooklyn. I was coming home from work up in way uptown in Manhattan at Columbia. And I knew I didn't have to go to work the next day. I knew there would be some quiet that I could do some writing in. And I said, well, look around, find some inspiration, listen to the world around you, pick it up. And I thought, well, stairs, look at those stairs. And I thought, well, stairs, there's something lasting about that design. The design of staircases hasn't really changed much. I mean, we really figured it out, right? And so we really nailed that. There's no innovation there to be done. And then I thought, well, that's the place to start. And I couldn't really imagine where a poem might go that started that way. But I thought I had to figure it out and to rise to that occasion, that observation's banal observation. Apologies from the ground up. The staircase hasn't changed much through the centuries. I'd notice it. My own two eyes now breaking down the larger vertical distance into many smaller distances. I'll conquer almost absently. The riser, the tread, the measure of it long hammered into the body the way it's always been. Even back in the day when the builders of the tower Nimrod wanted, rising up into the heavens, laid the first of the sun-baked bricks down and rose. Here we are again, I say, but where exactly, nobody knows. That nowhere in particular, humming between one phoneme and a next, pulse jagged as airless Manhattan-bound expresses on which I've worried years that my cohort of passengers' fat inner monologues might manage to lurch up into audibility at once, a general rupture from the keeping of thoughts to oneself. Statistically improbable, I know, but why quarrel with the dread of it? I never counted my own voice among the chaos, admittedly. I just figured it would happen not with, but against me, a custom punishment for thinking myself apart from all the others, but not apart from in the sense above, but away from, although to stand in either way will imply nobility, power, distinction. As, for example, if you step back to consider a 16th century depiction of the tower under construction, you rapidly identify the isolated figure as that of the king, his convulsive garment, the red of an insect smitten on a calf, the hint of laughter on his face or humming just under the plane of his face, indicative of what you have come to recognize in others as a kind of pleasure, no more or less so than in yourself, that can only persist through forcing the world into its service as it dismantles whatever happens to oppose it, including its own short-lived impulse to adapt by absorbing what opposes into its fabric. It will refuse to do that. It will exhaust its fuel or logic or even combust before it lets itself evolve into some variation on what it used to be, instead of remaining forever what it is until it dies, even when its death comes painfully and brings humiliation down upon its house. In the abstract, on and off, as when hurrying past the wrought iron fence some pink flowering branches cantilever through, or if pushed too relentlessly into oneself in public, it's hard not to admire the resolve in that. But there are pictures in which there is no king. The tower staggers into the cloud cover as if inevitably or naturally, as if the medium of earth were merely manifesting its promise. Often the manner in which it does so reflects the principles of advanced mathematics, so it's unclear whether the relationship between the two might be more appropriately thought of as one of assistance or of guidance. This distinction is a matter of no small concern to me, actually, because as much as I don't want anyone's help, I don't want anyone telling me what to do about 10 times more. And if what it all comes down to it is that, there's a far better than average chance I'll just end up devising some potentially disastrous third option on the fly as I wait in line. Elsewhere, we find teams of builders at work among the tower's open spaces with no one figure leaping forward as king or even foreman, a phenomenon whose effects include not only the gratification of our fondness for images of proto-democracy, but also the stimulation of our need to fill whatever we perceive to be an emptiness, which in this instance means electing ourselves into the very position of authority we had been happy to find vacant. I myself would be happy leaving every position vacant as an antique prairie across which bison once roamed democratically, each denizen of the herd voting for what direction it wanted to take off in with the nudge of its quarter-ton head. But someone around here has to start taking responsibility, and I don't see any hands going up. So here goes. Sorry, it was me. I built the Tower of Babel. What can I say? It seemed like a good idea at the time, and a fairly obvious takeoff on what we were already doing, architecture-wise. All I did was change the scale. I maintained the workers' enthusiasm with rustic beer and talk of history. Plus, the specter of the great flood still freaked the people out every heavy rainfall, so it felt like good civic planning, too. But apparently, the whole project violated the so-called natural order of things. I'm still a little shaky with the language in the aftermath, but my gut says that's just some dressed-up way of admitting I was really onto something. I call this unlimited soup. Thank you. Unlimited soup and salad. A little goes a long way when it comes to reality, and the question of whether we can know it directly, rather than just through the gauze of our experience, not that it makes that much of a difference when you're right in the thick of it, as when performing a bank heist or competitive mummery among family and friends, in which case your trust that the world is as it appears is more or less inviolate, if unself-reflecting, the way a honeybee trusts nectar and habits it's the petunia, or that her venom sac or gland or whatever it is will continue pumping its venom long after the stinger anchors in the forearm of the intruder, often merely an innocent passerby, having ripped off the hindmost furs of her body eviscceratingly, which is to say, along with much of her abdomen and digestive tract, plus whatever else happens to come with, a kind of surrendering as means of attack, which reads tragically wrong-headed in retrospect, although it does lend a vividness to the question of to whom the bee's business end belongs now, the one from whose person it juts, or her whose torn foreparts lie on the granite pavement lifelessly from having implanted it there. But when appetizers alone can fill you up, why bother gambling on the main course? It will only distract you from what you have come to rely on as fact relies on its verifiability in silence, and so totally you could almost weep for it, the way they do in Italy at the end of an opera, an era, or even the idea of anything familiar dying, a tradition, a truth, an olive tree fallen to fungus whose narrow leaves made with wind a conversation we had found to be rejuvenative to listen to, whose fruit and oil expressed therefrom we couldn't get enough of, whose shade could reform, and whose earliest ancestor, Athena's constant hand, did unveil in Attica as the greatest gift to humankind. Gifted. My breath sounded more like a recording of breath than actual breathing, and not a high-quality studio recording, but something cheap and muffled, something made on a small, lightweight device designed to be placed inside a plush white bear presented to a child on some special occasion. Plush white bear with the sound of my breath in it, a gift for a child with such low expectations. A toy of this kind should be cherished instantly and for a long time to come. But no, not this child. Child who isn't quite what we thought. Child who takes on inhuman proportions, who damages surfaces, who tears the bear apart with both hands and holds the recording device in victory against the sun. What comfort is it that the child is ambidextrous? What he will do with those hands is unspeakable. Two more. Diet Mountain Dew. This is my favorite beverage, or it has been my favorite beverage, but I'm trying to avoid it. It's not a good thing for you. Diet Mountain Dew. I have built my ship of death, and when the wind kicks up, I'll cut it loose to do its thing across an unnamed lake of you, a firefly sent pulsing through the nonstop estivation of the verses of our south, who in its larval phase would feast on bitter worms and snails, who emerges from its mud chamber, our planet's most efficient luminescence, who turns chemical energy into radiant energy, shedding very little heat, so will I sail the compass of you, pleased with my cold light. I have built my ship of death, aglow in sturdy chemicals and powered up at night like American Express. I'm all customer service, only minus the customer. No service to speak of other than death. You will know my logo by its absence and slogan from the past ad for the sugared style of you on TV in my youth. It goes like this. When my thirst is at its worst, and then I let it trail off into the unsayable, or is it just unsaid? Because my mouth is full of you again. A green like no other green in the dale, and delicate green or green indecent, surpassing the fern and sprout and April's optimistic leaflets, some stuff to admire in nature. They take photographs non-cognizant of other vehicles. You are too green for pasture. You are my green oncoming vehicle. Usurper of green, assassin to the grasshopper and its plan, I put me in your path, which is the path a planet takes when it means to destroy another. I think you know I'm okay with that. A green like no other green, resplendent in production since 1940, when brothers Barney and Allie Hartman cooked it up in Tennessee, qua private mixer named after moonshine. Its formula then revised by Bill Bridgeforth of the Tri-City Beverage Corp in 1958, year Lindward Burton, chemically inclined entrepreneur and ship cleaning service owner, sold his formula for a relatively safe maritime solvent to Procter and Gamble of Ohio, who went on to market it under the name of Mr. Clean, whose green approaches yours, then at the last second swerves into a joke. Yellow plays on green to make blue jealous till it blows up in its face, but I can't not love the smell of it. Citrus reimagined by an extraterrestrial lizard, which is to say inhuman in the way you say inhuman to me. A compliment unraveled in the drawl. Hey, you over there, you look so unaccustomed to temporality. I would have sworn you were inhuman. And time for it after time I fall. Further evidence of my humanity. I am at heart no less susceptible to rot than the felt hat on the head of the rifle-toting barefoot hillbilly, your mascot, until he died and disappeared in 1973. Instinct says he must have shot himself in the woods in the mouth one sunrise when a frost was at hand and the apples fell thick, and he was way too awake when he did so not to think there would be another waiting like a can of you in the 12-pack in my refrigerator. I have built my ship of death, and enough already. Every toxic sip of you preparing for the journey to bloviation. I leave to return and return to depart again the stronger for a satisfaction being bound to no port has afforded me. I have built my ship of death so that even when I crawl back down into the hold of it, alive as what unnaturalness and you can keep me. It's only to emerge from the other end of it intact and perfectly prepared to be your grasshopper. Here's the last one. It's a short one. The Endless. Thanks. Thanks, guys. The Endless. I saw a yellow butterfly flying, in my opinion, the wrong way, flying across the sound to Connecticut. I saw a cormorant, oily looking, flying close to the sea's surface, precisely as I floated on it on my back in the attitude of the crucifixion. Minerals in my body in conversation with the minerals of the sea. About the sun, how can I possibly add to what's already been said so well by the ancients and said with an austerity I'll never know? It is an honor to take a back seat to the ancients. Who knew how? I was a fat white fish dissolving under the sold-out stadium sun like a god, but like a god, I could live through anything. Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David.
Stand too. Okay.
Well, yeah, David can decide what he wants to do. I'm Jay Featherstone, and I'm very happy to introduce David Goulette. David has been a teacher for many years at Simmons, a teacher of English. He has done translations in Italian and Spanish. He has a long connection, political and literary, with Central America, and some interesting work has come out of that. He has been, you know, the institutions that keep poetry and literature alive are really important. I mean, we know that what an impact the Gloucester Writers Center has had on writing in our community, and in Cambridge, magazines like Plowshares, which David helped to found, have done that kind of role, and also theater, the Poets Theater, which he's had a long connection with, acting, directing, writing plays. Recently, fairly recently, he worked on a stage version of Seamus Heaney's Beowulf. As a poet, this Questionable Shapes, this book that you can buy here tonight, is actually his first poetry book, and it's a collection that's been gathered over many years because along the way, like many people, he has been writing poetry and finally has assembled it into this collection. Every poet wants to be a voice in your ear, right? And the voice we just heard speaking in this room is an amazing voice that will be actually in my ears for the next week or so. I say that particularly because I do think David's poetry is notable also for being voice music. I think partly it has to do with his long connection with theater. But these are poems, even when they're intimate or personal, they're poems that are meant to be heard by a voice out loud. That's not actually true of every kind of poetry, but I think these are out loud. The sweet spot for David is a person speaking in a room like this room tonight. So there's, and I should also mention that David is married to Margaret Morgenroth Goulet, who's a noted cultural critic, and who most recently you may have heard of her works, because she's done a lot of work in the recent decades about ageism and how the culture sees the aged. And so here's David.
Joe and I were actually in college together. But we only really met up at a Thanksgiving party, was it? Or Thanksgiving week party? And began to compare notes and realized that we had had sort of parallel lives. And it's such a pleasure to have a friendship with him, because he is now my favorite American poet. And if you haven't got a copy of Brace's Cove, run out and get one. It is, I think, one of the great undiscovered masterpieces of our generation. It's a terrific book. This book, called Questionable Shapes, some of you remember that that's a phrase of Hamlet's. It's broken up into sort of six parts, and I'm going to read a couple from each part. First part is about parents, and I'm going to read one about my father and one about my mother. My father's a terrible punster, so you know the term obiter dicta, which is a Latin term. And when Michael Collins was the first person to go around the Earth in a space capsule, he said, everything he says is an orbiter dicta. So that's the title of this poem, is Orbiter Dicta. stand up for Jesus, my father sings. My brother and I stand in the tub shivering as he scrubs our privates. The year is 1948, Raleigh. The moon slips clear of the tulip poplars. Then the rough back rub with clean towels, first one and then the other, and then to bed. If I get your nose, his breath heavy with whiskey, between my teeth, I ain't gonna let go. Challenged once to pun on that river for which there are no puns, he said, that's too Zambezi. Mm-hmm. He nails the Christmas wreath to the front door and adds a single rose. From the sheltered bush out back, De gustibus non est disputandum, goddammit. That spring, he takes the train clean to Detroit to save shipping on our first car, a DeSoto with fluid drive. Arrives home at 5 a.m., wakes us, and starts to sing Theophilus Thistle, the successful thistle sifter, just as the sun splits the sky. Or stands at the sunset bar, pouring his fourth or fifth, just a little dividend. At night, teach men that they are mortal. As I grow taller and cockier, if you were the new Keats, we'd know by now. True greatness shows early, my friend. Relax. Great poets suffer. You've been far too happy. Greatness, we'd know by now. 20, I stand on an island in Lake Erie, ready to hit the open road, Whitman and Kerouac stuffed face to face in my back pocket. An arm around my shoulder, his beery voice cheerless and low in my ear, you're better than I am. I never cut loose like this. I hitch west, out of his sight. 7 years later, Fiumicino, he alights from the chrome constellation. Be it ever so rubble, there's no place like Rome, filio mio. From the piazza above Florence, light floods the yet unflooded city. Has he ever been this silent? He shudders with joy and weeps. That winter, my brother bursts a vein. This is no false alarm. Come home. After the funeral, look after your mother. As though to say, staying alive will be more bother than it's worth. Now, everything grows fragile. Nowhere's out of harm's way. We're short of everything. Everything's for keeps. His final illness. I phone. Infracaninophilism. You know, love of the underdog. That's my motto, pal. A pause. Then plaintive, miles away. I'm scared. Hours before he dies, he whistles, wolfing down his food. Ma, says the nurse, we're certainly in a good mood, Professor. And he, hey, why not? It's Saturday night, ain't it? My plump-breasted little turtle dove. And here's a poem for my mother. Called Flo. My mother was convinced that a shipwrecked Spanish sailor named Murillo had swum ashore at the time of the Armada, married an English girl, and founded the noble lineage that led straight to the Twin Cities centuries later and to her, the child christened Florence Chamney Morell. She rhapsodized sunsets and genetics. She took her M.A. in bio at Vanderbilt about 1932. She and my father on the fringes of the fugitives. And a fellowship in English, your pappy was promised, was given instead to a young poet whose socks I used to darn, Randall Jarrell. She was drawn to painting and ancient China and bluefish. The busloads of children she talked through the museum, the buried ceramic legions at Xi'an, twin fish she once dragged out of the inlet at Fort Macon as the tide tugged the buoy and clanked its reluctant bell. Toward the end, her mind dissolving like cube sugar, we sat in the nursing home, the chaotic overload of overhead TV, dropped plates, broken laughter, moaning, cries of rage. And with her old, if slightly bewildered, curiosity, she asked, is this hell? Am I in hell? Jay told a wonderful story about part of discovering the poet in himself and discovering how important poetry was to him by taking a class with Seamus Heaney at Harvard. There were two older people and a bunch of undergraduates, and it sounds like it was a earth-shaking experience for him. We in the Poets Theater and we in Plowshares are also know and still miss Seamus terribly. But this poem begins with a little quote from Seamus as my epilogue. Finding a voice means that you get your own feelings into your own words, and that your words have the feel of you about them. Precociously picaresque, the poet sets out in search of a journey. He is every soul he meets and fights and kisses. He's no more himself than a bird is an egg. He borrows words but eats them without remorse. His song is all the top 40 played at once. His words have the hand-me-down feel of his alias brother crying farewell from the field where Gramps and Granny clasp in the gene pool, stitching the sails of light. And whenever he finds his voice, he flips the page, looks both ways, and opens the door of its cage. I have a lot of fishing poems. I'm going to read you one of them. I'll read you several of them. This is called Angling. In advance, much deconstruction and rebuilding. You guess what each part must do at a crucial moment, then memorize the whole. If every click is not dreamlike, you take it down again. Much bathing of stars and rings and springs in clear solvents. Letters with numbered codes and curious names go out at night to distant factories. Send one of each. The table is littered with bits of possibility. They await your refitting. Nothing too tight, too slack. You ask, can I throw it all out and bring it back? At last the day comes, you rise before dawn to disinter the long sleepers or dice up the dead. As for the place, you know in general, but not exactly which rock, ledge, spit, or jetty will say me, like a face from a former life. When you're certain what needs to be strong is strong, what sharp, sharp, and your murderous steel concealed in temptation, you take your pose, pause, swivel, and send your transparent filament arcing out into that swirl mapped only by the drowned. You scrunch down into your vigil, long or short, who knows? You cradle your rod, it comforts you. Even the pillow of stone is soft enough. You sleep and see the dark kingdom of the underworld, the vague shapes drifting aloof, those you have insufficiently loved, turning away in bitterness, in sorrow. And you wake to the last of the line, racing out. Something unforeseeably large is pulling away, and you brace yourself for the loss. Too late to slow it. Snap. I have some poems about poetry. I'm not sure where this is. I'm going to read you two poems about poetry. Actually, I just did. One from Seamus and the one about poets fishing. This is called Fame. And all of us want to be recognized, don't we? We poets, we writers. We want people to know our poetry and memorize it and write it. We want to be famous. We want our names to be on everyone's lips. But that doesn't always happen, does it? Fame. Half asleep, he saw clearly his own failures, and by the light of that hideous clarity, he made a poem, hard, sleek, and simple. As he strung the words out from the bobbin of his waking mind, still half dreaming, he knew what he'd seen, he saw what he'd felt, and each word rang a new bell or bruised an old wound to bleeding, but he pushed on to finish all the same. When it was done, he held it up and read the triumphant chronicle of defeat at his own hands, the craven appeasements, the months of capitulation, the years of friends after friend dying, and vices equal to his sorrows. He sent it off. Within days came word they would be glad to print it. The season shifted and he slept late. Then he was greeted by warm hands and bright eyes, beautiful women saying how much they loved his voice, ready to mother his scars with kisses. And he joined the rank of heroes for a spell. Time slipped away and below, and new poets bloomed in his stead, de-anthologized, calcified, half remembered, less than half the time, his waking nightmare lost its edge. Caked with shelf dust in 100 homes, or lost among geographics in a yard sale box. Until one bright Sunday, 60 or 80 or 40 years later, a woman's fingers spread these pages and pause for a moment. Her idle eyes skim the words like a bird with its beak half open in the surf. She says to her friend, hey, look at this. And they hunch together over the brittle rag, the faded pulp and linen, the old ink. The sun comes in the window or down the block or through the new leaves on the beach, uncurling like money. The poem is almost falling apart in their hands, but he dreams them there, frozen in distant time in a room, or a street, or a driveway littered with books. He sees them standing still for a minute or two, their eyes moving over the lines, reading. I want more fishing poem, if you don't mind. Poets fishing. Poets, we most of us, at least some of us, I speak for myself, just naturally love to go fishing. There is first the wonderful, effortless gliding over unknown depths, with only the merest skin between you and what could swallow you up. And the in-group paraphernalia, the tools of the trade, for initiates only, the private language, the gestures subtle and solemn, exchanged by conoscenti. In your box of tricks, a rainbow of lies, surgical tubing, piano wire, beads, glittering silver spoons, clips that swivel and dance, strips of the bleached pig, fragments of wing, lucid, translucent lines you scarcely know are there. You set sail dreaming of wide, incredulous eyes. You will dupe them into leaving home. They are thick, impossibly dull. You love them. To do with them what you will is your only goal. And the sweetness of repetition, even repeated failure, even a sort of perfected despair, back to the same place over and over, zero. Of course, sometimes the dead bob unexpectedly up, demanding rescue. This requires tact and grace. You can't just float away. You have to engage and grapple and call for help. The useless, putrid, tangled, obscene, and unreal are often all you'll end up with. Never mind, they'll do. Finally, the massive patience. Everyone thinks you are staring at nothing or half asleep or turned to some heavier substance. They're right. I'm going to read one that Jay said he liked. Called Four Kinds of Sleep, and each of the four, of course, as you'll hear, is a different time of the year. I love sleeping myself. And I love it winter, summer, fall, and spring. Number one, under the golden helices of the hornbeam, my nerves awash in a pollen of wanton rushes. I'm lying my mouth wide open on last year's leaves. Stretching these indolent joints, I yawn like a rose. Here is an endless appetite for fluff in the night from the south, silked over and over the face of the moon, like valium or petals or the pre-softened sheets of childhood I kept running over my lips. Two. Plenitude, sultry, cream, the surf, to suck. The sated garden, even the dirt is warm. Fruit swelling up under the heavy leaves. And voyages up trough and down the sweet salt foam, the distant lands, and the dreams of failure with beautiful women that stick to your back like a sweaty shirt. I never had to ask you as a child, said Mama. You always begged, now can I go to bed? Three. That year, the killer frost came early, and the children went out into the cold fields under the harvest moon. Each child found a pumpkin big enough to hide in, and did. Tossed out the seeds, cut the slits, but left the wedges in place so some light filtered in around, like your bedroom shade paled with night glow from the city where it is never really dark. Remember that day in the cave? We doused our lights, held our breath, and sat in the black. Number four, howling out of nowhere, this wind always blowing the bear in his ton of fat, snoring downward, down into black pools, past foam, past intelligent trout, past the salmon who all but cry, eat me, eat me, down through the years of even before he was, forgetting the slash and tumult, the roar of loss, hunkering down into a welcome nothing, sleeping the dream of ending that goes on forever. I love Henry David Thoreau. And I got a couple of poems that take off from lines in after Jay's book, that other great neglected book of American literature, which is Thoreau's journals. Thoreau's journals are really up there. I mean, they're doing competition with Walden and the great essays against slavery, such as Slavery in Massachusetts. It's called Overflow. And when I hold my fingers up, I'm quoting from Thoreau, because my lines and his lines go side by side. The 1st of February, 1855, Thoreau skates up the river. It swells beneath its crust, making a musical cracking, running like chain lightning of sound athwart my course. The rising of the mass lifts the ice in one place and drops it in another, the low patch filling with water to form quite a lake. And there where he has passed, and he imagines another skater, 2 hours later, his successor, who with wonder and alarm will see Henry's twin tracks disappear in one side of it and come out the other. Sometimes I glide across the brittle glaze asleep, and I'm above and in and beneath the dark currents and wonder at dawn, how did I drown? Only to glance back and see my tracks coming up and out and going on. I've got a section of poems which are mainly about love. My beloved wife is here, so this is a poem she will remember. We own a little cabin down in Westport, Mass., down by Fall River. Suburban Fall River, a wag calls it. This is called A Meditation at Sawdy Pond, S-A-W-D-Y. It's a Wampanoag word. I say we shall have no more marriages of sea to sky at dusk, of bird to beast when the lizard flaps her wings, of custom to nature when we dance, of love to loathing the instant passion dies. Each thing must be itself alone, exiled into certitude, each particle of dust its own shape, abhorring mud, each molecule of water named and numbered, refusing extinction in the mass, each man and the rock he moons on, outlined by an indivisible space. I say when a man rounds 40, he shall not be one with his youthful vices. He and they shall live in different rooms. He shall be only all of himself, atomic, without disruptive quarks or loose charms. Each thing will fall into place for such a man. He will love his wife and, despite everything, complete a sequence of possible tasks. Foster his seedlings. Bake brown bread, sit in his boat, smoking one cigar a week, watching the osprey trace with fixed wings the unambiguous boundaries of the lake. We love Mexico and Central America, but I haven't written a lot of poetry about that part of the world, but here's a kind of fantasy poem called Usumacinta. Usumacinta is the name of a major river that runs out of Maya country down into the Gulf of Mexico. So then it was Yaxchilan at the curve of the river, and everywhere a tropical density, tendril and cloud and thorn. All I said was, look what you've done to me. And you took umbrage in the shade of some gum tree or other, buried your face in a leaf mold of banyan and ceiba. For years, you said, I've tried to control my rage. Think what we've done to me. Think what you've done to us. Oh, said the toucan, flaming before the rain. Just when it couldn't get any worse, hissing downstream came the border patrol in their rubber crawlers. Halt! Whatever you're doing, stop! Later, in the prison at Washoktun, under the Guatemalan moon, we slept in each other's arms, atoned by Lear and Cordelia, afloat in our matrimonial hammock of Yucatecan hemp, rubbed smooth as dust by years of armed struggle. We two, grown lean and tough on the lore of attrition. My wonderful former student, Crystal Kandakis, is here tonight. And in honor of that, I'm going to read a poem which is said at Simmons. You know, that college professors have a kind of cycle to the year, and in May, at the end of the fine academic year, you read hundreds of blue books, and you just kind of got blanked out. And the weather is changing, and then the seniors, of course, are all leaving. Now, my name is Galette, so if you were going to call me Mr. Galette, but say very fast, it might come out as MYSTICALLETTE. So this is called Name Day. That's what I heard, by the way. They have cut the grass out back, and the shadows of trees are flat and distinct, stray pieces of puzzle flipped upside down on your father's billiard felt. Mid-May, end of a kind of year, I drop off my grades and drift in a haze toward our lot. What's left of my mind, sky blank from 50 hours of blue books and Mr. Colette. Lucid as bells at the end of time, a clean young voice from nowhere, sound of quick feet. Where? Dazzled, I turn. Oh, Mr. Colette. Goodbye, she says. It's been fun. Graduation, then Europe, then work. She wants me to know how great it's been. She glows on the sidewalk there in the sun. At dusk, in my yard out back, after hours of wordless weeding and grubbing about, cleaning perennial borders, moving Earth's babies around, I watch the thick wine bead and cling to my glass. I stand quite still in the undisturbed odor of lilacs. Off in the farthest trees, a bird is calling, Mr. Colette. All right. I think I better quit here. I'm going to read a couple little poems that are recent, haven't been published yet. For some reason, I was named the Sunday Poet by the Somerville Times last week, so I got a picture of me and a poem. This poem is called Girl Goes Green. It's dedicated to the hashtag MeToo movement and my sisters in that movement. And, of course, I suspect you will recognize the classical reference in this. He'd been after me for ages, so I took to the woods, planting myself in a hidden thicket, my toes lengthening root-like, nails disappearing into the sod, knees knotty, fingers caked with dirt, hair fernier, frondier, leafier, my lichen-covered limbs toughening, my shins barked and mossy, my sex. So when he made his long fantasized move, it was already too late. He bloodied his lip against what he'd been sure he wanted, but I had simply become what I needed to be. Daphne and Apollo. There's another one. My wife and I talk a lot about the myth. It's a myth about the Eskimos, which will come clear to you. And you all know the story about the other myth about if you put a frog in boiling water, in warm water, and slowly raise the heat, the frog will not freak out. It'll just, well, I won't explain it anymore. This is called Iced. The old Eskimo on her ice floe keeps a seal blubber fire going under the pot where the naive frog lounges in his personal jacuzzi that, yes, is getting slowly warmer, but all the same, down they drift toward the bay of exhausted proverbs, whose waters are less and less frozen every year. The emaciated polar bear clambers up on the floe and eyes the frog with disgust. And the old woman, with curiosity. I've heard of you, the bear tells her. When you're too old to, pardon the cliche, give back to the community, they set you adrift. Don't believe everything you hear, she says. I was bored with the long days and nights of childcare and food prep and love moans from the next furry blanket. So I'm on sabbatical. Call it a cruise. Let me end with one. Margaret and I have, for the last 30 years, we go down to Nicaragua for 6 weeks every winter as delegates of the Newton Sister City Project with a wonderful town in Nicaragua. It's changed our lives. This is actually the first poem I've ever written about that country I've been to for 30 years. called The Cave, which in Spanish is Cueva. Coming back from Escamaquita, past the curve at the peak, there was the Valley of Carrizal, with its steep mountain rising above it. "What's that up there?" I asked. "It looks like the entrance to a mine." "Oh," the old man said, "that's the Cueva de los Duendes." Duendes. I knew that word from Lorca's great essay. But he meant some dark flamenco trance when strummed sheep guts and a shout beyond reason jam in our ears the mesmerizing song of death. Here in the backwoods of Nicaragua, it just means little people. Fairies, minor local deities, trolls, semi-domesticated goblins, or witches. Things that rustle in the bushes after the moon rises, or borrowing feathers shriek in the sky above your chickens. Why do I feel this perverse relief that something remains here to challenge the cult of the soft Galilean and his stay-at-home mom? Some trace of the pre-Columbian, or something from the hills and caves of Spain smuggled in with the priests and horses. Once I was in Yucatan. An afternoon storm was brewing, and when the thunder shook the limestone world, the old Mayan lady at the kiosk looked up and said, "Jacques, the god of lightning, rain, and fertility." Remember how Wallace Stevens's Crispin, hearing a rumbling west of Mexico, fled and knelt in the cathedral with the rest? The thunder unleashed the self possessing him. Some quintessential fact that was, he says, not in him in Connecticut. My idle thought passing through Carrizal was to find a way to climb the hill, enter the giant portal of the cave, probe the interior with my LED, but to know a thing is to kill it, says Lawrence, and I'm too old to court more disenchantment. So back to town, a little rum, check the banality of the internet, news of winter's vacancy back in Boston, a little European music to sprinkle on the sizzling red snapper. How easy to live it, this, our minimal, unhaunted 21st century life. Thank you.
Thank you, David and Timothy, for providing a wonderful evening tonight in Gloucester.